It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. If you're a fan of the 90s Comedy Central series Mystery Science Theater 3000, you may be familiar with Cinematic Titanic. Just like Mystery Science Theater, it's a group of comedians giving commentary on feature-length movies. Not always the greatest movies, usually the bad ones in the science fiction or horror genres. Here's a little taste of what it sounds like.
I'd like to invite all of you to stay here for the duration of your visit.
Well, I don't know about Paul and Carla, but I really can't even begin to do my work unless I live with the people.
Oh, well, la-di-da.
You don't have to be that democratic, do you, Doctor?
Well, I...
We accept. Paul, you know you'll do much better work after you've had a nice, hot shower and slept in a honest-to-goodness bed.
I'm too sexy for my lines.
How can I refuse?
That was a clip of Cinematic Titanic riffing on Danger on Tiki Island.
Well, the group's on its farewell tour. They're performing at Milwaukee's Pabst Theater tonight and tomorrow night. They've all come to our Milwaukee studio now to explain what they do and give a preview of the show.
And we want to know, are you a Mystery Science Theater 3000 fan? What do you think about riffing off movies? It's something you like to do when you've got a really bad movie that you just kind of love. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post your favorite bad movie on the Central Time Facebook page. And we've got with us in the Milwaukee studio a whole bunch of people. We've got Joel Hodson, Mary Jo Peel, Frank Conniff, J. Elvis Weinstein, and Tracy Beaulieu, cast members of Cinematic Titanic. Guys, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Hey,
I have to correct you. It's Trace Beaulieu.
Oh, no.
He gets really, yeah. I'm
Trace
looking at him
Beaulieu.
Right now.
Yeah, I'm pulling Trace wires Beaulieu out of the back of
yeah,
this
yeah, here it goes.
I practice constantly on my way to the bathroom, and I still got it wrong. So
we'll
fine.
Go back and do it again.
I'm sorry. No, that would mean dead air.
Oh.
All right, Joel, let's start with you. You created Mystery Science Theater 3000. What sparked this idea for you? How'd you get it off the ground?
Oh, boy. I think it was a fairly obvious idea. It seemed like it at the time, and I was kind of surprised nobody had done it. But really, I was just trying to come up with the cheapest TV show I could imagine. And it just so happened I got together with these people, and we were able to, get it going. It started at a UHF channel in Minneapolis, KTMA. And am I getting that? Yeah, KTMA, right. And we did it locally. We did about 22 shows locally, and that's really where we figured out how to movie riff. I just came in kind of going, oh, there'll be these silhouettes, and they'll say funny stuff, but the real, growing it and kind of figuring it out came when we all got together in the room and started figuring it out. So we got this nice long time to develop it, and then we brought it to Comedy Channel, which became Comedy Central, and they bought it.
It sounds like something kind of organic. You do it when you're hanging around with your friends in college or whenever, and you're watching a bad movie. But is there kind of like, science to it, to making it funny for real for people to watch, Joel?
Oh, boy. To me, it just comes from having fun, and it's kind of like it's just trying to find what's enjoyable about it. If you try to be funny, that's often harder than just trying to have fun and making something that people will like, I think. So I guess I don't really know of the formula. It's just kind of like, working at it and getting good at it.
But you've done workshops on this thing, right?
I've done it, and there's not really much to it. It's really about running a movie and kind of letting people know they have freedom to kind of say what they want. And the big thing is just not being too cynical. I think you're kind of a companion with these people watching a movie, and they don't like being around jerks. So you have to be kind of, dimensional and kind of, you use the movie as a springboard to get to other ideas and have fun with it.
Well, Elvis, let's go to you. How would you describe the plot of Cinematic Titanic?
The plot of Cinematic Titanic is five people making fun of things, really. It's not a lot of story there.
The story comes from the movie.
Yeah, each movie's plot is the plot of that Cinematic Titanic. But for us, it's as if we're five stand-up comics on stage with a movie.
And tell us about what movies you're taking off on coming up in Milwaukee.
We are doing, tonight we're doing The Doll Squad, which is a...
Which I've never heard of.
And you probably wouldn't have heard of it.
For good reason.
It's a sort of female Delta Force kind of
Charlie's Angels kind of
awesome.
Yeah, supposedly it was an inspiration for Charlie's Angels.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Except Charlie's Angels didn't have any inspiration in it. So
it had really great hair, though. What more do you need?
Well, so does Cinematic Titanic.
Excellent.
And a really sexy speakerphone.
Well, Frank, movie riffing, it does seem kind of like an art. I mean, when you guys get together and there's five of you, how do you decide what's funny and what isn't funny?
Well, a lot of that is instinct, I think. And a lot of it is, you know, it's a craft as much as it's an art. To do it professionally, which it entails writing a script, you know, watching a movie over and over again, writing a lot of lines, rewriting, looking at other people's lines, and then just kind of coming to a consensus of what the funniest line is for a particular moment in the movie. And luckily, we've all been friends for a quarter of a century, and we have very similar comedic instincts. We're very similar in terms of what makes us laugh and what we think is funny. So just organically, there's usually a pretty good consensus about what jokes are funny and what aren't as funny.
Trace, do you ever fight over the best line? Someone says, no, I want that line.
We have never come to blows over a line. it's very generous the way we write and distribute the lines. And often we found that an audience member will come up later and say, I really like that line you read. And I'll go, well, that was Mary Jo who said that. But thank you anyway. So people don't know. They can't differentiate. You're in the dark. You're watching the movie. And that's where your focus is. So it's easy for people not to really identify sometimes. But I'm just happy if I write a line and someone else says it and they get a big laugh, that's very satisfying.
What's your favorite, one of your favorite lines, Mary Jo, in Cinematic Titanic? What gets a big laugh?
What gets a big laugh for me is a line that I accidentally stole from Jay Elvis, and then he was generous enough to give it to me. I got flustered and I read it, and it's really hard to describe it out of context, but in Danger on Tiki Island, there's a woman who is very aggressive with the men, and she encounters a monster, and the monster is looming over her, and there's this flicker across her face where she honestly looks like she might be considering the encounter. And the line I stole from Jay Elvis was, oh, she's thinking about it. And it gets a huge laugh because it seems very true in that split second. I always anticipate when that line is coming up in the script because I enjoy it so much. And I just am so loving toward Josh that he gave me that line. So
after you quote, accidentally stole it.
If it works.
Right. No tension there with lines, clearly. Mm-hmm. What are your favorite movies to do this to? I mean, these are not the only movies that you've applied your craft to in Cinematic Titanic. What are some other favorites, Frank?
Favorite movies that we've been doing in the show? Well, we did one called we did a Roger Corman movie called Wasp Woman, which is really fun to do. Roger Corman supplied a lot of movies for Mystery Science Theater. He wasn't trying to supply them to Mystery Science Theater, but he ended up being a major supplier. And that one is, and there's another one called East Meets Watts, which is a blaxploitation film. And that's really fun because we never really did that genre when we were on Mystery Science Theater. So it's always fun when a new genre comes up. You know, we always do, we've done a lot of science fiction, a lot of horror movies. But when something that isn't within that particular genre comes up, it's, for me at least, it's really fun.
And Elvis, let's ask you next. What's different, you think, about doing these shows live versus doing them, you know, pre-recorded, which was the old Mystery Science 3000 way?
Well, the real difference is that any joke, you know, it doesn't just go off into the ether. It gets a response right there and then. You know, it's and as we are all stand-up comics. Originally before we came into Mystery Science Theater. And so, I mean, that's kind of the natural way that a joke is supposed to play, where you tell it, you get your response, and it makes it a more energetic experience, I think. And I think it it brings out the best in us to have an audience there. You know, it makes you really want to sell a joke. It was very easy to do jokes that didn't have an audience when we were doing Mystery Science Theater. We could do a joke that literally five people on the planet would get, you know, and we wouldn't have to pay for it, you know, because there, you know, it goes off into the ether, and there's also 400 other jokes for everyone else. So, to answer your question, the real thing that's different is just the energy and the sort of conversation that's going on between us and the audience, and it allows us to change the show from night to night and keep wanting to make it better so that every joke gets a laugh that we do.
Joel, I want to ask you about that creative process again, because I imagine that it sounds like it'd be a dream job for you guys. When you're first watching a movie, nobody's seen it before except maybe someone who brings it to the group. Do you sit around drinking beer and eating nachos and just having fun and riffing all night long?
We all live in different places, so we do it remotely, and then we kind of bring our ideas together. We kind of merge them together, and so you're kind of on your own. It's like watching the movie and going through it, you know, piece by piece. It's almost like animation in a way. You're looking at it moment by moment and looking for ideas based on what people are saying or the visual. Like the strongest jokes are always based on what everybody's seeing. And so a lot of it has to do with what is the picture and do I have a moment to say something? And then we bring it all together. We each write, I don't know, probably 500 or 600 riffs per movie, bring them all together, and then we each kind of produce a segment and put all the jokes together and kind of arrange the material and arrange who says them. So that's really our process. And then bringing it on stage, like we're going to do tonight and tomorrow at the Pabst. Good seats still available, by the way. I think we're almost sold out, though, right?
Okay, so yeah, but there
if
are
you're
some
driving
seats.
Out of Milwaukee, turn around and come back. But the big part is, like Josh was saying, it's the audience. You know, what's great about this, it's a great way to get the material really sharp because you're working with the audience, and they're the ones telling you if you're on the right track or not, you know?
All right, well, we're talking right now with the cast members of Cinematic Titanic. They include Joel Hodgson, Mary Jo Peel, Frank Conniff, J. Elvis Weinstein, Trace Beaulieu, and together they're Cinematic Titanic.
We want to know from you, are you a fan of Mystery Science Theater 3000, which they created? Did they introduce you to Manos, The Hands of Fate, for better or worse? Do you have a favorite so bad it's good movie? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or post on our Facebook page, Central Time on WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk to the manager of a program that opens up some of Milwaukee's most interesting buildings to the public.
Right now, we're talking to the cast members of Cinematic Titanic, the creators of Mystery Science Theater 3000. We've got a room full of them in our Milwaukee studio right now. And you can join the show at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Mystery Science Theater? What do you like about it? Watching people talk about a movie, a bad movie. Do you have a favorite bad movie? 800-642-1234.
And let's go to the phones right now. We've got Stephanie with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi.
What do you think?
Oh, I love Mystery Science. It just always has me laughing.
So is this something you've been with a long time? You've been watching it?
I did get to watch it on occasion when I had the pleasure of going to my friend's house who had cable, but not in recent years. But I would like to recommend a movie for them to check out.
What is it?
It's called The Pit, and it was made in the 60s here in Wisconsin in my hometown of Beaver Dam.
Love it already.
Done.
Oh.
That's great.
It features a lot of locals that I know.
So excellent.
Like, oh, I know him.
What is the plot, Stephanie?
Oh, all right. So there's this young boy who has some sick sexual tryst ideas.
Okay, never mind the plot.
Hey, why didn't they just call it Beaver Dam? I think that would have been an awesome movie if you had giant beavers and they're putting up a dam in the city and, you know.
I don't know. I assume you guys haven't heard of that one yet, Mary Jo?
No, have not. And we've heard of a lot of them, for sure.
I bet you have. All right, there's one to add to your list. Let's go to Brian in Madison. Hi, Brian.
Oh, hi. Say, I'm a big fan of Mystery Science Theater, and I love the simulcast you did of Manos about a year ago, I guess it was.
And I yeah, that wasn't us. That was Riff Tracks.
That was Riff Tracks.
Yeah. But glad you enjoyed it.
That was not you guys. Oh, I'm sorry.
We get mixed up a lot. Yeah, it's the
We have another phone number we can have you call for them.
Is it fair to say that Riff Tracks is really an homage to you?
No, Riff Tracks is just us, the other version of us, because they're from Mystery Science Theater as well, and they just live in a different part of the country, or you know, so they do all this stuff too, and it's also really good.
So Mystery Science Theater 3000 has really budded like a sponge and gone off in these different areas.
Yeah,
that's right,
exactly.
All right, let's go to Jesse. Jesse joins us from Turtle Lake. Hi, Jesse.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
That would be a great movie too, Turtle Lake, with a giant turtle.
A double feature, Turtle Lake, Beaver Dam. Beaver Dam.
Yeah, it would be kind of slow, probably.
Yeah,
but
actually, there is a movie, Clear Lake, for the town just right down the road. To be honest.
Oh,
okay. Every Wisconsin town has a movie. I think that's what we're learning.
You're gonna have to stick around longer, I think.
Oh, exactly. Well, I grew up watching you guys on Channel 23, Elton Cities, and I absolutely loved you.
Oh,
and
thank you.
One of my favorite movies I ever saw from you was the Gamera movies. What did you guys think when you first saw that rocket-powered turtle out of Japan?
whatever the Japanese word for ka-ching is.
Frank, I like your take on the Gamera series. Do you remember your great line where he's like the reoccurring character?
Yeah, he was like became like a on our show kind of, right? Is that what I meant? Like, because we did 5 Gamera movies, and we did every possible joke. One line I remember from the Gamera movies, which just shows how like sometimes the simplest lines are the funniest, was there's a scene where Gamera is swinging on a pole like over and over, and then someone just says, you know what, it just occurs to me, this is a really weird movie.
I think, too, that when the Gamera series landed in our laps at KTMA, it just happened to be one of the groups of movies they had, the show really kind of found its footing. We realized, oh, this is like what we should be doing. And we were really fortunate in that we got to do it at KTMA locally in Minneapolis. And then when we did it nationally on Comedy Channel, they were able to license the Gamera shows again, and we got to do it again, this time when we were getting paid to do it. So we had more resources to actually write it and really do a good job with it.
J. Elvis, do people ever, you know, come to you and say, you know, I made this terrible film, it bombed, but because of you it's gotten a second life, thank you?
I think no one has ever come to me specifically like that, but I've anecdotally heard people being very happy that their movies have sort of reappeared on the radar because they were on our show.
Yeah, Rick Sloan, who made Hobgoblins, has been very appreciative of the second life that Mystery Science Theater gave that film.
Sorry,
so bad
America.
It's good. I'm curious, you know, now that you've got this live show, it's different than the taped one. Anyone have any stories about crazy things that have happened during these live shows?
No, you know, our fans are so well-behaved and polite people in general that they really police themselves. You know, people have asked often if, you know, do people come to our shows and shout out their own jokes, and it's like, nope.
Yeah, also, I think that the ticket price has a lot to do with that, too. When
you're saying you keep out the riffraff.
40 or 50 bucks for a ticket, you don't yell stuff out. You are there to, like, watch us do it.
All right, let's get in one more really quick call. Kevin in Madison is next. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
We're good, thanks.
Yeah, Mystery Science Theater, wow.
And thank you, Kevin.
Okay, next call.
Well, I mean, I remember sitting down in one of my friend's basements when we were in school and watching these movies over and over again. I have a couple of favorites. One was, of course, When the Earth Stood Still.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. Oh, yeah, that. Well, that's a good movie, though. The Day the Earth Stood Still. That's a really genuinely good movie.
And we'll have to leave it with Kevin's wow. I think that's a great sentiment to end on. Guys, thank you so much for cramming into the Milwaukee studios, and have a great show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We've been talking to the cast members of Cinematic Titanic. They include Mary Jo Peel, Frank Conniff, Joel Hodgson, J. Elvis Weinstein, Trace Beaulieu.
Coming up, we'll talk about an event in Milwaukee this weekend that lets people peek behind the doors of some of the most interesting buildings in the city. Stick around. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Noah Ofshinsky joins us for his weekly roundup of Wisconsin news.
First, a unique event in Milwaukee this weekend lets people check out what's behind the scenes in some of the most interesting buildings in the city.
It's the third annual Doors Open Milwaukee. Around 130 buildings will be open Saturday and Sunday for public and private tours.
Amy Graw joins us now. She's program manager for Doors Open Milwaukee. Amy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, neat idea. What gave people the idea? Like, we've got these interesting buildings. We want to let people look around inside them. Where'd that come from?
Well, originally, the first program manager for Doors Open, Doors Open Milwaukee, started in 2011 by George Wagner, who was the program manager prior to me. He attended Doors Open in other areas, other cities around the nation, and thought, well, Milwaukee has some really great historic buildings and great stories to tell about our buildings. Why don't we bring it here? So he hooked up with Historic Milwaukee, and who's presenting this event every year. And thus, now here we are in our third year with almost over 15,000 people attending last year and hopefully more this year.
And it's growing, more and more buildings, right, each year?
Yes. The first year was about 100. Last year in 2012, about 120. And this year we have 134, so yes, it keeps growing.
Now, are we talking just the older historic buildings?
Oh, no. No, it's our entire built environment. There's buildings on there that are as new as 2012. There's sites that aren't even buildings, like Blue Dress Park or Havenwood State Forest. There's a lot of different places in Milwaukee. We call them sites instead of buildings, because not everything is actually a building in Doors Open Milwaukee.
But the idea is still you get to go behind the scenes, kind of.
Yes, yes. You get to view many different things. I'd say that a good 60% of the things that you get to see at Doors Open, you would never, 70 maybe, you would never be able to see on a regular basis or a daily basis.
Well, going down the list, one of the really interesting types of buildings in Milwaukee, the cathedrals, the churches. What are a few of the big churches and cathedrals that people can check out during the event?
We have a lot of churches that participate in Doors Open. It's really a wonderful addition because there's so many different denominations that during Doors Open, it's just one of those times where people can feel comfortable no matter what their beliefs, or maybe entering all these different churches to find out the history and the architecture of each. I think one of our most notable ones is the Basilica of St. Josephat, which has participated last year and this year. It's a wonderful building, 1896. Is when it began, and it's really a compilation. They decided they wanted to build a church. They didn't really have enough money to do so, so they learned that the U.S. Post Office and Custom House in Chicago were slated for demolition. So the entire buildings were purchased and dismantled and loaded on rail carts, 500 rail cars, and they brought every piece back to make the basilica. And the outcome is amazing. It's definitely worth viewing for Doors Open.
And we spoke last month about the mystery around the Germania statue that used to stand on the Germania building. Is that one going to be open?
It is. For the first time this for Doors Open, it'll be open this time. So that will be exciting. I'm not quite sure. I don't think you get to go all the way to the top, but there are many little hidden intricate features that you'll be able to see in the lobby. And they have a very bizarre parking structure that I know that they're going to feature and highlight at the Germania building.
And you've added a passport program, you're calling it, for kids and families, I guess a kid-focused one. What's going on with that?
We've had it all 3 years, actually. Oh, okay. And what we do is, because it is so overwhelming for families, if you're bringing children, especially small children, into this event, and you're thinking, this is all history and architecture, my children, I don't know if they're going to get it or enjoy it or be able to sit there for a while and listen to it. We highlight every year 24 buildings or sites that are deemed kid and family friendly for Doors Open, and they know that. We put them in a passport, 24 sites that are free for children, and you can pick them up at any of the 24 sites that we highlight each year and go from there. And that way, kids feel that they can go to each one, get them stamped. And it's a fun thing for kids to hold on to and understand and learn about 24 buildings that are within the 134 that we offer. Plus, it's a great guide for families who feel a little overwhelmed by the list as to where to start.
What are you hoping people learn or see in Milwaukee that they didn't know before because of Open Doors?
So many different things. It depends on what you're interested in. There's so many different great views of the city that you would never be able to see unless you're attending Doors Open. There's every single neighborhood in the downtown central area, and now that we've sprawled out this year more than any into some of the outlying areas, I'm really excited for people to see something like Thurston Woods or Havens Woods State Forest Park. There's some great outlying here. Calvary Center Cemetery Chapel is also involved on Blue Mound, or something as south as the Milwaukee Fire Museum. We've delved out a lot this year for Doors Open, and we started in the central area and have been moving outward. And so I'm really excited for people to be able to approach Doors Open coming in from the location that they're starting and be able to start earlier as they approach the central hub of the downtown Doors Open Milwaukee.
What's one of the most interesting things you've learned or seen as you go behind the scenes on these Open Doors buildings and sites?
Well, I think probably some of the really neat ones that I've approached. I really like Jones Island. Jones Island is one of probably my most favorite tours, born and raised in Milwaukee. But I didn't get to see and take every tour for Doors Open this year, I wish. But for the 134 buildings, 37 in-depth tours and 7 public tours, that leaves you with about 200 things to see this weekend. And so one of them I did see was the Jones Island Water Treatment Facility. And you would never guess how interesting seeing what goes on with your water and how it goes from the sewage source into a clean water source. It's completely amazing. It's a wonderful, wonderful tour that I highly recommend.
And then what's on your must-do list that you haven't done yet? What's the one you keep thinking, oh, I wish I could hit that one if there weren't so many other ones to see?
Personally, for me?
For you, yeah.
Yes. I've always wanted to go to the III Shrine Center and check that out. I've seen that top of the dome for the III a million times driving past, so I'd like to see the inside of that. I've never been in there, so that would be really exciting for me. The Polaris is new this year, the Doors Open, and I know it's been around for a while. It's been closed for a few years, but they're letting people go up and check out the revolving restaurant that once was up there, and I think it is actually going to revolve for Doors Open. So I've never personally been up there, so I'd like to see the view of Milwaukee from that angle. The Modern is another place. It's a condominiums complex on Juno and 3rd, Old World 3rd Street. It's new. That's another great example of a new one. That would also be a wonderful view from the top because it's from the northwest side of the downtown area. Plus, I would love to see the insides of some of the condos because I've heard that there are some famous Milwaukee people that live in them.
What's the response from a building owner when you approach them? Are people like really proud and excited to do this, or are they kind of leery, like about letting a bunch of people tromp through their buildings?
It depends on security. The federal courthouse, for example, we really have to work at figuring out how to get people in and out because it's a highly secure area. You can't go into the federal courthouse on a regular basis. But for Doors Open, you can. Northwestern Mutual is another example. Only employees are allowed inside Northwestern Mutual. It's highly secured security purposes there. So it depends on how much is involved on behalf. But no matter what, once the building owners participate in Doors Open and see all the positive things that come from it, they almost always participate the next year. So we haven't really had a problem with that. For every site, we have at least one or two people that are knowledgeable or are the building owners of that area that are on site in case people have extra questions or, you know, if they would like to know more of the history that is more than what is offered on the general public tour. And then we also have 400 volunteers for Doors Open stationed at every building, and they will also be there to help and guide anyone who has any questions.
Amy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Amy Graw, Program Manager for Doors Open Milwaukee. You can find a link to that event on the Central Time on WPR Facebook page.
Coming up next, Noah Ovshinsky joins us to round up the top Wisconsin news stories of the week. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time. It's time now for a look at what made news in Wisconsin this week.
We've got Noah Ovshinsky in the studio with us now. Noah's our assistant news director. Hey, Noah, thanks for coming by.
It is good to be here. Good afternoon.
Well, let's start out with Badger Care letters. Something's afoot with this starting Monday.
Right. So I know we're supposed to be looking back, but I want to look forward for a second because I think this is a big story. On Monday, roughly 90,000 Badger Care recipients, and Badger Care is the Medicaid program here in the state, 90,000 recipients are going to be getting a letter in the mail letting them know that they're going to be removed from the program because under new guidelines advanced by the Walker administration, their income is too high.
And any sense, you said 90,000?
Yeah, 90,000.
That's a lot of letters. So what's going to happen when they get these letters? What information are people going to be given?
Well, they'll probably have a lot of questions. You know, what's next? When is my insurance going away? What is my insurance going to look like? And the Walker administration's goal is to get these 90,000 folks off of Medicaid and into the insurance marketplaces that were created by the Affordable Care Act. These online marketplaces where there'll be a variety of insurance companies here in the state offering their own plan, and the federal government will kick in some money, some subsidies to help people pay for that insurance.
Now, the obvious concern here is lapses in coverage. So what is the Walker administration said about trying to make that happen?
Right. That's one of the concerns that they have, is that continuity of coverage, because these marketplaces aren't going to really go into effect until early next year, I believe in January. And so I think the Walker administration wants to get out as much information as possible, reach these people as early as possible, and get them in these new exchanges if possible.
Any concerns about affordability? If people can't afford Badger Care, is there going to be a jump in price for something new?
Right. That is a huge concern for people who are advocates of those who need health insurance or who don't have health insurance, or those who rely on Badger Care right now. That's one of the big concerns, because these 90,000 folks, while they may not qualify for Badger Care because they make too much money, they also, the concern of critics, is that they don't make enough money to pay for this new insurance, and that they may get substandard insurance or may not get insurance at all because they can't afford it.
Now, as you said, that's a big news story. So when these 90,000 letters go out, is that going to be big news for people who might not be expecting it?
I think it will be. Even for those who can afford the change, I think it's going to be, you know, there's a dramatic difference between dealing with, say, Medicaid and dealing with a private insurance company. There are different claims processes. There are different customer service experiences. There are different coverage levels, things like that. And so people are going to have to really give a lot of thought as to what their health insurance is going to look like. And for some of these folks, maybe they didn't have to think about that for a while because they've been on Badger Care. And so now all of a sudden they're going to be in the private marketplace, which is different than government-run healthcare.
All right, let's move on now. There have been a couple of polls making news in Wisconsin this week. One about the Solidarity Singers.
Right. So I'll admit, I'm not a huge fan of polls. And I wouldn't normally talk about polls in the Week in Review because it kind of lends itself to this horse race mentality when it comes to journalism.
But
here comes the, you know, it was coming. Here's the but. The but is, these are the first time that we've gotten polls that deal with these particular issues. The first one is a poll that asks people if the Solidarity Singers, the protesters at the Capitol, should get a permit in order to protest, which, of course, has been an issue we've covered at great length here on WPR. And this is the first time we've had a poll that really looks at, does the state of Wisconsin support it?
And what did it find?
Well, nothing too definitive. The poll did find that a plurality of people, so not a majority, but more people than not, support the Solidarity Singers' right to protest without a permit. 41% said they should get a permit. 45% said they should not. And it has to be said that 4% is within the poll's margin of error.
Right. And so, I don't know, I guess this is news happening at the state capitol, but it's large enough, apparently, that people have heard about it elsewhere
right.
in Wisconsin.
So for me, in addition to this being the first poll, the surprising thing is, and this even surprised the pollsters, and this was a national polling company, by the way, that did this. They found that 86% of voters actually had an opinion about the Solidarity Singers, which means there are a lot of folks in Wisconsin who are actually following the issue and who care enough to have an opinion.
And, you know, you said within the poll's margin of error. So how influential is this poll going to be when people are considering this issue on both sides of the legislative fence there?
I think either side can spin the numbers in their own way. I mean, it's not definitive. But what it does say is that there are, you know, not equal, but roughly equal numbers of people, according to this poll, who support them or don't support them. And more importantly, as I noted, that a lot of people in this state actually care about the issue, 86%.
So since it's actually on people's radar, maybe that's enough to up the ante a little bit.
Right, exactly. And it also has to be noted, Public Policy Polling is a firm that did this, and they're often looked at as a Democratic or a left-leaning firm. Mm-hmm. They did note that in this poll, they did seek a mix of respondents. Interestingly enough, the same group of people that they polled for this favored Governor Scott Walker over four hypothetical Democratic opponents in a governor's race.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
So not just a partisan issue here.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. It goes both ways.
All right. Well, let's move to another poll. This one is out of UW-Superior. Tell us about this one.
Right. So again, this is another first poll that we have. And this is University of Wisconsin-Superior researchers came out with the first public opinion poll that looks at what people think about the proposed open pit iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin, which is very controversial here in the state. And all of the respondents live in the two counties where the mine would be built.
And so just to get our terminology straight, so the open pit mine would mean basically, you know, they're taking off the top of the landscape.
Right. It's like I've heard the term like 4 miles wide, basically, or 4 miles long. And that's where they would extract the ore on the surface.
On the surface. Okay, well, what did this one show about how people feel about this open pit mine?
So this showed that the majority, more than a majority, really, of the people that live in those two counties oppose the mine in some way. For instance, 62% of respondents absolutely are opposed or are generally opposed to the mine. 44% of that were folks who just absolutely were opposed.
So that is a lot more clear than the Solidarity Singers poll.
Yeah, not a plurality. That's a majority.
Opposition going on right there. And how do you think this will, you know, play out, a poll like this? Will it be influential?
Well, you know, again, I think it probably depends on where you stand in the mine. If you're against the mine, you'll point to the poll as proof that this isn't popular. You can also, if you're for the mine, you may point to it and say, well, you know, there was only 102 answers, and there were only 102 answered the survey completely. So it is a relatively small subset of people. It also has to be said that of those people who support the mine, and in this poll, 11% fully support a mine, 14% generally support the mine. So something on the order of 25% you know, they support the mine. And when asked why they support the mine, they largely pointed to the employment opportunities that it brings as a reason for supporting it.
And for folks who were in the oppose camp, what are their concerns?
Their main concerns had to do with the effect of transportation infrastructure, tourism, outdoor recreation, quality of air and soil, surface water, forestry, wetlands, fish and wildlife. So mainly issues having to do with the environment.
So it sounds like, you know, from what you're describing, a lot of people have a lot of mine literacy. They're following it.
Yeah, exactly. And just like the Solidarity Singers, a big part of those people actually had an opinion about it. So this poll found that a lot of people were well-educated about the mine issue. 70% say they are following the controversy closely.
All right. So we'll be watching that one. That's obviously still in development on lots of fronts. And moving to education, you know, a different kind of report card came out, not just for kids. This time it was for schools themselves from the Department of Public Instruction. Tell us about that.
Right. So DPI released its annual report card of school districts and individual schools. And what the report card found was that a majority of Wisconsin schools met or exceeded the expectations set down by DPI.
So now how does that compare to last year?
Ooh.
Do we know?
Good question.
Did I stump the assistant news director?
Oh, you stumped me. Okay. Oh, no, I've got a partial answer. Let's see. So let's look at Milwaukee. Milwaukee is one of the districts that did not score, compared to other districts in the state, did not score as well. And according to Milwaukee officials, the number of schools that are meeting expectations in Milwaukee went up from 29 schools to 34. So there is some improvement, at least in the Milwaukee Public School District.
And yet it sounds like Milwaukee suffered, you know, on another front, though.
Yeah. I mean, they still have, a lot of really a lot of improvement that needs to be done. It has to be said also that this is the second year individual report cards have been released. And so we're just now getting a sense of what the data looks like. And you know, I think everybody, both parents, policymakers, and others, will be looking at successive report cards and really thinking about where are we and where do we need to be in order for all of our districts to meet or better yet exceed expectations.
And how is this by and large being perceived? You said that the majority of Wisconsin schools met or exceeded expectations. So, you know, are we patting ourselves on the back?
Yeah, I think so. Governor Scott Walker released a statement saying the report card results were great news for parents and children. However, he did note that there still is room for improvement. And really the goal for him and the state government is to have no failing schools.
All right. Well, that's another one we'll be watching and we'll be tracking it again for next year. Noah, thank you so much for stopping by today.
It was great to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. Of course, that was Noah Ovshinsky, our assistant news director here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, we'll take a look at how the military is using video games in training, recruitment, and in other ways, too. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.